I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My guest today, Dr. David Behrman, MD, is one of the most clinically knowledgeable physicians in the United States in the field of medical marijuana and will appear on the Holistic Health Show on Saturday. He has spent 40 years working in substance and drug abuse treatments and prevention programs. Dr. Behrman was a pioneer in the free and community clinic movement. His career included public health administrative medicine, provisions of primary care, pain management, and cannabinology. His almost 40 years professional experience in the drug abuse treatment and prevention fields include being the co-director of the Haight-Ashbury Drug Treatment Program, being a member of Governor Reagan's Interagency Task Force on Drug Abuse, a member of both the Santa Barbara and the San Diego County Drug Abuse Technical Advisory Committees, and a consultant to Hoffman LaRoque Santa Barbara County Schools and the National PTA. He has been recognized by the Santa Barbara Medical Society with the Humanitarian Recognition Award. Dr. Behrman is also the author of Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools, How Discrimination and Greed Create a Dysfunctional Drug Policy, and How It Can Be Fixed in 2 volumes. More information is available at davidbehrmanmd.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Behrman, and I look forward to hearing about cannabis in cancer treatment. Now, first, how long has science demonstrated that cannabis kills cancer cells?
Well, the first study that I'm aware of occurred at the Medical College of Virginia in 1974, and it was reported not only in a peer-reviewed medical journal, but in the popular press, for instance, the Washington Post. And since that time, there's been literally hundreds of basic science and cell culture studies that have been done that have demonstrated cannabis anti-cancer effects.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what kind of evidence do we have?
We have dead cancer cells. The studies that have been done, there was a really good review article written by the University of Wisconsin in 2008 that went into 15 different cell types that could be killed by cannabis and cannabinoids. Research has been done all over the world. It's been done in Madrid, been done in Italy, been done in Jerusalem, demonstrating the anti-proliferative, anti-cancer effects of cannabis and cannabinoids. It's one of the great tragedies of our time that the United States government has pressed research on any of the medical attributes of cannabis, and particularly the anti-cancer effects. I mean, it's just inhumane, really.
Mm-hmm. Is cannabis effective on all types of cancer, or is it more effective on some than others, or has that been researched?
It really hasn't been determined. I mean, as I was saying when we were talking before we got on the air here, I think that the glioblastoma, which is a brain tumor, breast cancer, and lung cancer have the most anecdotal reports. But as I indicated, the University of Wisconsin report in 2008 talked about 15 different cell types. The way that it works is that it interferes or suppresses angiogenesis, which is the formation of new blood vessels. And of course, cancer tissue, like any tissue, needs to have oxygen and nourishment. So that interferes with the growth of the cancer. Also, it interferes with metastasis. That is a cancer going from the primary site to distant site in the body. And lastly, it encourages apoptosis, which is cell death of old and abnormal cells. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, it has far fewer side effects than conventional medication. The conventional medication is going after rapidly reproducing cells, and it appears as though the cannabis is going largely after the abnormal cells.
Mm-hmm.
So the side effects with cannabis are much less than the side effects from chemotherapy and radiation.
Mm-hmm. Great, good. And what kind of research is going on today?
Well, there's a lot of research that is going on with animals. I mean, there's an organization called the International Cannabinoid Research Society. They meet every year. They usually have over 100 presentations that are made on various therapeutic aspects of cannabis or various ways that it works at the cellular level. And there's usually several research studies that are presented dealing with the anti-proliferative effects. Dr. Manuel Guzman and Dr. Cristina Sanchez in Madrid are doing quite a bit of studying on the use of cannabis for treating glioblastoma. In addition, research on glioblastoma in humans is being done in the United Kingdom by Roger Pertwee and in Dr. Raphael Moshulam's lab in Jerusalem. In addition, you have a good deal of research that continues in tissue culture and with animals. And also there's a study being done in San Francisco on breast cancer by Dr. Sean McAllister. He's basically attempting to get funding to do that study. So we have a lot of anecdotal evidence, and it seems like it would be appropriate for the federal government to step up, but it doesn't look like they will. Fortunately, there's quite a bit of money that is being generated in the medicinal cannabis business, and some of these entrepreneurs have more willingness to fund this kind of research than the federal government does. So I think that we're fortunate with the changes in the laws and with the attitudes of some of the people who are involved in the industry that they want to see more research and more good quality research done to determine whether or not cannabis can, in fact, cure some cancers.
Mm-hmm. There's often recurrence with chemo. Has this been studied yet in cannabis, or is it too early?
Well, it's for one thing, you're right about being too early, is because of the stigma that's associated with cannabis and the difficulty mm-hmm. of getting funds from the government.
Mm-hmm.
We can't say that the cannabis will cure cancer. What we can say is that we have these anecdotal reports that suggest that some people have attributed the remission of their cancer or the disappearance of their cancer to the use of cannabis. But these aren't double-blind studies.
Mm-hmm.
We also know, though, that the same kinds of environment that led to the cancer in the first place remain after the cancer cells are killed, and so it may recur.
Mm-hmm.
And what most lay healers, and that's who is supervising the use of cannabis for cancer, not usually MDs, but mm-hmm. lay healers, what they recommend to their patients is to take about 1 gram of concentrated cannabis a day for the rest of their life in order to decrease the likelihood of having that particular cancer return.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no double-blind studies to report that. Again, there are some anecdotal reports that people who had been using the 1 gram a day and stopped did have a return of their cancer, and the people who continued to use it did not. But again, without having studies, this is all interesting anecdotal reports, and there's plenty of justification for us to do the studies that I'm making reference to that should be done. And I hope that some of the people listening to the program here are in a position to either do that research or fund that research.
Mm-hmm. I thank you for clarifying, because I think so often, and I'm included, we get the lab studies mixed up with human studies.
Right.
And so,
yes,
and you can't
there's no
do
question,
that.
But what we have, plenty of lab studies,
mm-hmm.
and we also have plenty of anecdotal reports, but we don't really know what this actually means. I mean, does it mean that this was just a happenstance, this cannabis was just incidental? Does it mean that sometimes the cannabis is useful in treating various kinds of cancers, or does it mean that it always is helpful? And we don't know the answer to those questions.
Mm-hmm. I think this raises another question, too, when they said that when the healers think that patients should take this indefinitely, there probably has not been research on long-term effects yet on humans either, right?
Well, where everything is sort of right, dose-related and strain-related, one thing we do know in terms of the long-term effects of cannabis is that in 1978, we had the start of the Individual New Drug Program, which was set up for the federal government to provide cannabis from their farm at the University of Mississippi to eventually became 15 people. And these people all had medical problems. They didn't add anybody after 1992 because the program was stopped then, and they had the people that were already on it continued on it. And there was a study done in 2005 by Dr. Ethan Russo and by Mary Lynn Mathra, who's an RN, Russo's a neurologist, on four of the then seven surviving members of the government's IND program, which was supposed to be a research program, but the government didn't do any research, and Russo and Mathra did. And what they found was that except for the underlying medical condition for which they were taking the cannabis in the first place, that there was no abnormalities in that group. Now, these are people that had been using cannabis for 30 plus years and been consuming between 7 and 9 pounds of cannabis every year. They mm-hmm. were smoking 300, 9-tenths of a gram cannabis cigarettes a month, or in the case of one of the patients, he consumed his every 3 weeks. So they've been using cannabis for a long time, but they'd only been smoking it. They mm-hmm. hadn't been eating mm-hmm. it, and when you smoke it, you don't ingest as much as you would from the dosages that are required in order to hold the cancer at bay. But we do have these studies on people who have used cannabis for 30 plus years. But in terms of the maintenance dose for keeping the cancer from returning, we don't know what the long-term effects mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. Would be.
Then, Dr. Perelman, what do you think is the most pressing issue on medical cannabis today?
I think the most pressing issue is the lack of education in medical schools on the endocannabinoid system. The endocannabinoid system is considered to be the largest neurotransmitter system in the human brain, maybe the second largest, and yet only 13% of medical schools teach about the endocannabinoid system. You can hardly get doctors to understand the medical role of cannabinoids if they don't understand how it works and the neurotransmitter system that it works on. So I think that is probably one of the biggest barriers to having increased appreciation and increased understanding of the benefits of the medicinal use of cannabis and also the mechanism of action for medicinal cannabis. So that would be my response in terms of what's the number one problem. And I think, you know, the other problem is that the United States government really needs to get out of the way. I mean, if we take a look at the decision in a 2004 case called Gonzalez versus Raich and look at the dissents, in that case, it was a 6-3 decision. The three dissenting justices were three of the four most conservative justices on the court. Mm-hmm. on the court. Mm-hmm. And they pointed out that the federal government has no authority to regulate the practice of medicine. The Ninth mm-hmm. and Tenth Amendment to the Constitution, a 1925 Supreme Court decision called Linder versus the United States, which was never reversed, says, look, the states regulate the practice of medicine. Mm-hmm. And there is a 1942 decision called Wickard versus Filburn, which has generally been railed against by conservatives, railed against by the late Anton Scalia, who voted with the majority in the 6-3 decision, which reinforced Wickard versus Filburn, which is Scalia was probably one of the court's great hypocrites, in that he had been an outspoken critic of Wickard versus Filburn, and yet when having a chance to put his money where his mouth was, sided with the so-called liberals and abandoned the conservatives on the court who were supporters of states' rights. The states do have the right to regulate the practice of medicine. Wickard versus Filburn stretches the Commerce Clause beyond all recognition and gives the federal government more authority than was contemplated by the founders. And of course, with the current president, he doesn't understand the Constitution at all, and he's trying to get around the Constitution in the same way that I think Scalia was trying to get around the Constitution.
That makes it difficult, doesn't it, for patients when states make decisions? Because, like right now, it's legal in California, right? But it's not in many other states. And so.
Right, but that's the way we're set up. There's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, it isn't.
You know, really. I mean, that the state, we have, that's the system of government that we have. You know, if you don't like it, you can go someplace else. But with the federal government is not a dictatorship, regardless of what Mr. Trump seems to think. The states have rights, and the federal government, according to our Constitution, has limited powers. They don't have unlimited powers, and they have no power, no authority to control the practice of medicine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if your readers are really curious about this, they should read Sandra Day O'Connor's dissent in Gonzalez versus Raich. Raich is spelled R-A-I-C-H. And I think they'll be find that some interesting points on states' rights. Now, those of us that are your age and my age remember that the racists like to rely on states' rights, and there's a tongue-in-cheek, facetious statement amongst cannabis supporters that states' rights isn't just for racists anymore.
What I'm thinking, though, is that with patients, and it looks like it's effective for pain, and especially, and for at least killing the cancer cells in the lab. And they're doing all kinds of things, I understood, for Mara in California as far as dosing and all. But yet that's not available to people in many states because many states still have it illegal.
Right, and they have every right to make it illegal if they want to. You know, what the people need to do is elect people who are not going to put science down and put scientific discoveries down. Apparently, some people feel that they would rather go with their fantasies than with the reality. First off, the federal government really has no authority to make cannabis illegal, but the states do. And if they want to, they can. And if the people don't like it, they should vote for people who are more interested in people's health than in pandering to the lowest common denominator.
Great. Good. And is that how we will get it in medical schools and the places where it needs to be, you know, educate the federal government and all through political process?
I hope so. I'll tell you this. There are a number of organizations that are out there. I'm the executive director of one of them, the American Academy of Cannabinoid Medicine. But there are several other organizations as well that are interested in educating not only the general public, but more importantly, doctors and medical schools. And so I think that there's this pent-up demand for education, and we're beginning to see resources step forward to meet that demand. And the more anecdotal reports that we get, the more that physicians open them up to the science, the more likely we are to see an increase in the percentage of medical schools and nursing schools that are teaching their students about the endocannabinoid system. Last November, I gave a four-hour presentation at Seattle University to the faculty of the School of Nursing because they're considering adding a unit on the cannabis cannabinoids in the endocannabinoid system. And there are a lot of us out there that have seen the benefits to our patients of the medicinal use of cannabis that are urging medical schools and nursing schools to include the the largest neurotransmitter system in the brain in their neuroanatomy courses or in their physiology courses. And hopefully we're going to see more of that, not less of that. I was looking at the internet just today and see that there's a couple of undergraduate courses at Humboldt, which is a prime marijuana growing country in California, and at UC Davis, which is a agricultural school and also has done some research on medicinal cannabis, that they are teaching some courses on that now. And I think we're going to see more of that. I've been involved in drug policy reform and drug abuse treatment and prevention for almost 50 years, and I have seen a change in the attitude in the courtroom. I do expert witness work. I've testified as an expert more than 500 times. About 150 to 200 of them have been cases involving cannabis. The other have been cases involving other psychoactive drugs, that there's more of a willingness to listen to the science, but there's still an awful lot of just junk science or prejudice or stigma that that comes through that has nothing to do with the effects of cannabis. And so the more education that we get, the more that changes, so that people have more of an open mind in terms of looking at cannabis as they would any other therapeutic agent.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to see that Washington is still progressive as far as nursing, because I've been out of academia since 2000, but Washington was one of the more progressive of the states in the past.
Now, were you at the School of Public Health in Washington?
No, I've never been, worked in Washington. I was in academia here in Virginia, but I have a doctorate in public health, so I kept up on nursing and public health for the years that I was in academia. And Washington was always one of the, Washington, California, New York tended to be the three states that were more progressive.
Right. Now, here's the problem with Washington is they looked at their law and mainly focused on the taxes that they would get from the recreational use and have downplayed the medicinal use.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated from the University of Washington School of Medicine, and I'm very disappointed to see Washington do that. I mean, I think it was great that they have had drug policy reform, but not so great that it was done, at least in part, at the expense of pursuing the medicinal qualities of the substance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I read your vita, and you have been so involved in this field and the whole drug abuse and all for so many years, and I see you also were on a task force for Ronald Reagan when he was governor.
That's true. He put together what he called an interagency task force on drug abuse, and a friend of mine wanted to be on the medical group, and I went with him to the California Medical Association. One of their staff people was staffed to this interagency task force, and they had a youth task force. And at the time, I was under 30, and if you recall, in the 60s, they said you can't trust anybody over 30, so I was under 30, and that qualified me as a youth, and I was on the youth task force for a little while there, Reagan's Interagency Council. Now, the interesting thing is that at one time, they were going to have a meeting of all of the different subgroups that were on there. There were like 25 of us that were on the youth task force, and they never did call a meeting of everybody. I don't know if they were afraid that we were going to take too liberal a position, or they wouldn't be able to control us, or what. But we did. Our group, I know, met several times, maybe on a quarterly basis, and I was involved for a couple of years in that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what we can say about Reagan and drug policy. I think that Reagan, on a national level, was a disaster. If you take a look at his alleged philosophy, we have wasted almost $1 trillion on enforcement of drug laws since Nixon instituted the war on people who use drugs that he didn't like. And this is just the federal dollars, not the state county and city dollars that have been spent. So we've spent well over $1 trillion in enforcing the, you know, the war on people who use drugs that we don't like. And of course, the drug war is not a war on drugs. It's a technique, it's a tool, it's a strategy for marginalizing discriminated against groups. And there's nothing new with that in this country or in the world. If we go back to the time of the pagans, they were marginalized by the Christians for their use of drugs, and the witches were healers, and that was considered heretical to help a woman not have as much pain with delivery by use of various herbs as she would without the use of those herbs. And it was considered getting into the business of the priests who were supposed to do the healing, and also that women were supposed to suffer during childbirth because of, allegedly because of Eve and the apple. And I mean, all of those things are ridiculous. And then in the 15th century, when the witch's bull was put out by the Pope, he also demonized cannabis, in part because it was an analgesic, and, you know, basically said it was a tool of the devil. So, I mean, we have these really absurd agendas that are out there, and people who have political statements to people who want to preserve their own power. And cannabis isn't the only substance that has been used to marginalize people. In a book I wrote called Demons, Discrimination, and Dollars, probably the best line in it was, "We wouldn't have the drug laws we have today if it weren't for the Irish," which really is a tongue-in-cheek jab at the British. The British thought that the Irish were subhuman, and therefore they couldn't hold their liquor. And when the Irish Catholics started coming over to this country in large numbers during the potato famine in the 1840s, that's when we started to see the turn from the temperance movement to the prohibition movement. And then it only got worse as we had a larger number of immigrants come into this country. And prohibition was really a technique, a method for attacking certain discriminated against groups, the Irish, the Germans, the Italians. It clearly was an abysmal failure, as the prohibition of cannabis has been an abysmal failure.
We touched on pain management. Can you tell us about what has been found as far as cannabis and pain management?
Cannabis has been in every materia medica, every pharmacopoeia ever written, going back to an ancient Chinese one to, by oral tradition, was written in 2637 BC. The oldest hard copy of a materia medica is one for Ayurvedic medicine from India, and it goes back to somewhere between 1800 and 1700 BC. And all of these materia medica include cannabis, and amongst the therapeutic applications is analgesia. We did a little study amongst a couple of prominent cannabinoid medicine specialists and found that the most common reason for recommending cannabis was for analgesia. We also have found that the average opiate dosage declines by 30 to 50% when the person adds cannabis to their therapeutic regimen. There was an article that appeared almost 2 years ago now in the Journal of the American Medical Association that pointed out that in states where medical marijuana was legal, there was a 30% decline in overdose deaths due to overdose from opiates. So there's no question that cannabis is an effective analgesic, and that it can be used in conjunction with opiates, and that when used in conjunction with opiates, it frequently decreases the dosage by 30 to 50%, and in some cases, the patient is able to stop using the opiates entirely.
That's great. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And it's also good for, you know, arthritis, because in addition to being an analgesic, it's an anti-inflammatory. My oldest patient is a 99-year-old physician with arthritis. You know, the nice thing is that not only does it help relieve his pain because of the analgesia, but it also decreases the inflammation, and it has very few side effects. So it's a pretty good drug for a 99-year-old to be using.
Right. Then, Dr. Behrman, is there anything else you'd like to say before we look at your services, products, book, etc.?
Yeah, there's one thing. There is a very conservative congressman here in California named Dana Rohrabacher. And I've heard Representative Rohrabacher speak at HempFest, and he was very well received. And I have to say I agreed with almost everything he said. And then this fall, he spoke at a program in Long Beach called the State of Marijuana. And in that presentation, he opined that then Mr. Trump, now President Trump, would likely legalize the medical use of cannabis. Mm-hmm. And the reason that he said that is he said he knew that Donald, which is how he referred to Mr. Trump, used topical application of tincture cannabis to relieve arthritic pain in his shoulder. So I think we need to watch and see whether or not Representative Rohrabacher was correct in his prediction about what Mr. Trump would do. I think the other thing that I would say to your listeners is it's important to educate your doctor about the medical value of cannabis. I have noticed a gradual thawing of some of the hostility towards people's use of cannabis. And I guess the other thing, you said we're going to get into products. I have written a book entitled Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools, How Greed and Discrimination Led to a Dysfunctional Drug Policy and How to Fix It. Mm-hmm. And that's currently a two-volume book. But at the end of this month, we hope to come out with a slightly smaller one-volume book, and I think you'll find it really useful. It frames the cannabis laws within the use of all kinds of drug laws to marginalize, discriminate against people, and really points out that cannabis is not unique in that particular respect, that these laws have been used throughout history as a way of targeting specific groups and pushing them further to the margins.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good. Then would you tell us then about your services, products, books?
I guess I'd start off with urging any healthcare professionals that are out there to go to the website of the American Academy of Cannabinoid Medicine. We are an organization that tries to set standards that we want to recognize those doctors who are practicing good quality cannabinoid medicine without screaming and hollering about those doctors that really are doing a disservice to the medication by spending only a short period of time with each patient. Another thing I want to mention to people is, well, I'm awfully busy and don't really need any more patients, but I am in the practice of cannabinoid medicine in Goleta, California. You know, you can give us a call if you want, 805-961-9988. And the other thing is I have written this book. It's available on Amazon. It's, the publisher is Blue Point Books, and it has its own website. Again, it's called Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools. And we're going to be coming out with the brand new edition within the next 3 or 4 weeks. And I would encourage people to watch for that. Last time when we came out with the first edition, I was on a number of radio interviews and a couple of TV interviews. And hopefully you'll see me around on the media when the book comes out.
Now, do you have a website connected with yours?
I do. My personal website is davidbehrmanmd.com. And there's no capitals, no spaces. Behrman is spelled just like the bears in the woods. Mm-hmm. B as in boy, E-A-R-M-A-N, David Behrman.
That's great. And this has been very, very interesting and very helpful, I know. And I'm glad for some of the clarifications of things that, like the lab versus the human studies confusion,
right,
and some of the other things that have been confusing. I hear a lot about this on Facebook, and I'm sure a lot of that is correct, and a lot of it's not quite so correct. And so
that's true. There's a fair amount of misinformation out there, but there are a number of good websites that are out there. I mean, certainly ours, AACMSITE.org. It's the American Academy of Cannabinoid Medicine. There's also an outfit called the International Cannabinoid Research Society, and they have a lot of good information on their website. One other thing is I'm coming out with a book, and that will probably be about 6 months from now, that it will be for doctors who would like to be cannabinoid medicine specialists.
Mm-hmm.
It gives some of the background, the historical background, talks about the endocannabinoid system in the brain and about the cannabinoids in the plant and their therapeutic value, talks about dosing. It'll be coming out in 3 or 4 months. It's directed at the medical community, but for patients that are interested in educating their doctors, it would be something that would be useful for them to have as well. But that's not on the market yet. We haven't got a title for it yet. I'm about 40% into completing that book.
Mm-hmm. This would be appropriate for naturopathic doctors also?
Yes, for nurses, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Good. Well, again, I appreciate this very much. It's been interesting, and it's been a pleasure to talk with you, Dr. Behrman.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your many years of service in public health. I think the American Public Health Association is a pretty impressive organization, and I see that they honored you, and I'm damn impressed.
Thank you. Because we have some time left today, I would like to talk with you about my new cancer foundation and an opportunity that I think will be of interest to you. My new cancer foundation can be found at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. On the site, you will see first a video of the foundation. You will also see the goals, which are education, research, and patient care. I have an impressive board and advisory board for this foundation, and you can look at these on the site. I have worked for over a year getting content on the site, including interviews with cancer patients and doctors, cancer research, cancer treatment, and what is different on my site is research on mental, spiritual interventions and interviews with experts for interviews like affirmations, visualization, prayer, meditation, gratitude, forgiveness, and many others. These are included because I believe that disease results from multiple factors, and consequently, a holistic approach is necessary for recovering from cancer. To me, prayer, faith, optimism, and others are as important in treatment as medication, supplements, diet, and other interventions. I have experience to support this belief. Having used a holistic approach since 1970, when I volunteered as a camp nurse for the Edgar Cayce organization, it was natural to use this approach when I was diagnosed with lung cancer in 1974. Curing this disease with all natural holistic interventions, I continued using the approach in my personal life and with clients, and am now considered a pioneer in holistic health. I have worked for the past 5 to 6 months on the website section on prevention of cancer. This finished in a download gift of this material, around 50 pages, available for those who donate $12 or more to the foundation and receive a tax deduction receipt plus this gift. The booklet available as a download, titled Reduce Your Cancer Risk, A Holistic Approach. It will include the following. First, as a longtime educator, I like to start my writing with a theoretical framework in which to place the content. So there is first a theoretical framework based upon public health concepts. This framework will basically look at, first, ways to reduce the risk of known environmental carcinogens, and second, ways to strengthen the host against environmental and other carcinogens. Content on reducing the effect of known environmental carcinogens include electromagnetic waves, toxic chemicals such as BPA, formaldehyde, toxic metals such as aluminum and mercury, and last, ultraviolet waves. For all areas, there will be research related to the carcinogen, what you can do to reduce the risk, and an interview with an expert for many of these. The second part looks at ways to strengthen the host or you against carcinogens. It includes areas such as physical activities, nutrition including genetically modified organisms, organic foods, etc., fluids, water and milk, supplements, vitamins, minerals, immune builders, sleep, smoking cessation, music, and then it moves into mental, spiritual interventions that includes affirmations, compassion, faith, forgiveness, gratitude, meditation, optimism, prayer, relaxation exercises, serving or helping others, social support, stress reduction, and visualization. Again, for each of these, there is research, what to do to strengthen yourself against cancer, and interviews with experts for many of these. You will hear interviews with 30 cancer or related experts on mental, spiritual interventions, such as forgiveness, gratitude, faith, and compassion. You'll hear about omega-3s, genetically modified organisms, genetically modified food, plant-based and other nutritional diets, smoking cessation, chemical and mental carcinogens, immune builders, music, and much, much more. So I hope this will be helpful to you and will help in preventing cancer in the future. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey, on my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernatural alternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.